one of the distorting lenses on the political moment of now, not just of now, but of our entire lives, has been the question of capitalism and the dividing line between the so-called right and left being one of supporting or opposing capitalism. The left have this view that the right is reactionary, the right is always on the side of power, that when capitalism decays, you get fascism and so on. And so they want to place everybody on this continuum, from left to right, where left is communism as described by Marx, etc., and right is anybody who opposes that, namely the capitalist. And then you get libertarians who also have their, the flip side of that, where they want to define right as total free market and anything opposing that further to the left. Trouble is that that is just not true. As a figure like Peter Hitchens, a figure like Aaron Bastani shows, the opposition to capitalism first came from the so-called right, from the forces of reaction, from romantics, from defenders of the older aristocratic order who did not like the new upstart bourgeoisie, the merchant class, coming and shaking up the social order. Certainly, this was the case in Shakespeare's day. In fact, why don't I play my Foundations of Shakespeare ad, and then I'll complete this little lecture when we come back.
Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Foundations of Shakespeare. Buy it now. Now, when you're critiquing capitalism from a conservative point of view, generally what you're looking at are the social bonds, you're looking at the sense of community, and you're looking at how commodification, commerciality, consumerism successively break down those bonds. From the left, they tend to focus on inequality, but I still think there's a similar distaste for ribald commercialism as against the artisanal, the artisanal values of the old-fashioned craftsman or the individual artist. This is actually a sense of common ground. And I think that there's a capital R romantic sense on both, the left and the right. I think Peter Hitchens definitely has this in his work. I think Aaron Bastani, especially as he's getting older, has this. I was interested to watch both of them on a panel recently in a debate about Donald Trump and whether to have. They were actually on the same side of that debate against Mary Harrington and somebody else, as to whether Trump is a good thing or not. Now, I don't really want to go over, that particular debate. I was just interested to see Hitchens and Bastani on the same side, because I actually think the trajectory of, conservatives and of leftists who have, they're coming out of this woke nonsense now, is in this direction, that where the common ground, it's not really going to be about left versus right in the old-fashioned sense anymore, but there are going to be questions about, well, what is it, are there things of the past that we can preserve and protect? Do we want all of the villages of England turned into multi-story car parks and Milton Keynes, right? And that is something that both Hitchens and Bastani would likely agree to, and most people watching this, whether they're left or right, have that sense. These old arguments, socialism versus capitalism and so on, they feel tired and they feel like they belong to an old era. Now, in this video, I'm going to show how this was there pretty much from the very start of our current paradigm. Here's Thomas Carlyle, who was writing in the Victorian era, and he was notable for being a man of the quote-unquote right. He was seen as being a reactionary, and he was a big influence on Charles Dickens, but he was also a very firm critic of capitalism. He was critiquing it from an older sense. He was critiquing it from a spiritual sense, from almost from an anti-materialist, metaphysical standpoint, and a much deeper critique of capitalism than you'll find in most critics of capitalism, I would argue. In his book, Past and Present, you get a sense of his rhetorical style. I'll just read it. "Behold, supply and demand is not the one law of nature. Cash payment is not the sole nexus of man with man." How far from it? Deep, far deeper than supply and demand are laws, obligations sacred as man's life itself. These also, if you will continue to do work, you shall now learn and obey. In sad truth, once more, how is our whole existence in these present days built on cant, speciosity, falsehood, dilettantism, with this one serious veracity in it, mammonism? So Carlyle did not like the encroachment of cash payment to all factors of life. He would have been appalled to look at the state of country today with its multi-story car parks and endless chains of McDonald's and Burger Kings and, you know, this foreign company and that foreign company. You know, Carlyle, I mean, if he would return to London now, I mean, that's not the only thing he would be appalled by, of course. He'd be appalled by lots of other things too, the diversity and so on, and he would hate it. Now, interestingly, a little bit later on in the Victorian era, one of the readers of Carlyle, or two readers of Carlyle, were Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. And here's a bit of a longer passage from the Communist Manifesto, but I think we can detect in Marx and Engels some residue of that rightist critique of capitalism. Now, obviously, they're coming from the left and they're much more interested in the plight of the worker and the equality and so on and so forth. You know, this is, I would say, the right-left divide is chiefly on the question of equality. But yet, some of that romantic sense of Carlyle is retained, nonetheless, in Marx and Engels. Let me just read this passage. "The bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production, and thereby the relations of production, and with them the whole relations of society. Conservation of the old modes of production in an unaltered form was, on the contrary, the first condition of existence of all earlier industrial classes. Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast frozen relations, with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions, are swept away. All new formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned, and man is at last compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind. The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. The bourgeoisie has, through its exploitation of the world market, given a cosmopolitan character to production and consumption in every country. To the great chagrin of reactionists, it has drawn from under the feet of industry the national ground on which it stood. All old established national industries have been destroyed or are daily being destroyed. they are dislodged by new industries whose introduction becomes a life and death question for all civilized nations, by industries that no longer work up indigenous raw materials, but raw material drawn from the remotest zones, industries whose products are consumed not only at home, but in every quarter of the globe. In place of the old wants satisfied by the production of the country, we find new wants requiring for their satisfaction the product of distant lands and climes. In place of the old local and national seclusion and self-sufficiency, we have intercourse in every direction, universal interdependence of nations, and, as in material, so also in intellectual production, the intellectual creations of individual nations become common property. National one-sidedness and narrow-mindedness become more and more impossible. And from the numerous national and local literatures, there arises a world literature. Now, obviously, the angle of the communists is different from that of Carlyle, but you can see they see what Carlyle sees. For Marx and Engels, this is a kind of inevitable force of history that will bring about their world revolution. It's a necessary stage in capitalism. But they can still see something of the nobler structures of everyday life, as Fernand Braudel would call them, in the kind of unchanging peasant life, let's say, of the old feudal era, which stayed the same, stayed essentially static and rooted for a long time. And I think they recognize something like a drive within lots of people that sees certainty and safety in this. And this is what Carlyle always wanted. Carlyle decried what they're describing as nomadism. Now, when I think of Donald Trump's voter base, I do, right, even though Trump has allied with these tech billionaires and they're talking about Milton Friedman again and all of this, most of his base, who come from those former industrial areas, who just look around and see the wasteland of the Rust Belt and so on, and remember when there was car manufacturing, and they remember when, America was a leader in this area and that area. Now it no longer is because of this process that Marx and Engels are talking about. And when they talk about getting their country back, what they've got in mind is something like that. Now, unfortunately, for them, they've allied themselves to these rapacious capitalists, the Elon Musk and all of these other tech billionaires who have a very different vision. You know, they are actually up for this constant change, right? The constant revolution that Marx and Engels are talking about, and the rule of cash payment or the universal cash nexus that Carlyle is talking about. So you can see that the actual desires and dreams of an essentially reactionary movement like MAGA, or like what is coalesced around Trump, their ends and their desires are actually not fundamentally quote unquote capitalistic. And yet, because a lot of these people, you know, they're kind of feeling rather than thinking, or because, you know, they're just kind of going to follow Trump everywhere. And because America's always been the land of capitalism and freedom and so on, you know, they don't stop to ask any of these fundamental questions. And so, you know, lo and behold, now they're buddied up yet again with the very force that has got them here in the first place. But I think that as people have become more and more serious, they'll start to see that the root of many of their issues is actually this globalizing system. You know, it used to be global, you know, globalism versus nationalism. That was meant to be the new battle lines. But I don't really see it coming with this alliance between like high finance, Silicon Valley and Trump. I just don't see how those ends are going to connect whatsoever. I think that there's a certain amount of trickery going on, and a lot of people can see it. I just thought I'd linger here a little bit, because what I'm talking about is something that a lot of people kind of feel, but they can't quite put their finger on. A figure like Morrissey, like, is Morrissey left-wing, or is he or is he right wing? Well, in the 80s, when Thatcher was around, you know, it was de facto assumed that Morrissey was a man of the left. When he started, you know, voicing more patriotic thoughts or opposing immigration, and you know, then people both were like, "Oh, what's happened to Morrissey? He's become a right winger, an evil." You know, there are people who won't even listen to the Smiths anymore because they see Morrissey as a hateful figure. But the truth is, Morrissey, I think, has always had this capital R romantic sense that leads to, you know, that it comes from the same place, in my view, as somebody like Hitchens or somebody like Carlyle, and the, his distaste for aspects of capitalism, I think are kind of misread, or they're kind of shunted off into, oh, well, that must mean he's left-wing because he didn't like Thatcher. Or and this is a very confusing thing that throws a lot of people off. But I should mention a number of people who are generally seen as being on the quote-unquote right, who were skeptical of many aspects of modern capitalism. There's Arnold Toynbee. Now, again, at different times in his career, he would have been seen as a leftist or a rightist. You can't really categorize these people easily, but he saw the dangers of commerce. He saw the dangers of what happens when the elite, the creative minority, as he called them, were only merchants who only cared about cash payment and profit, and how that distorts a culture and how it may speed up civilizational cycles. This is what Toynbee wrote about. Another writer who talks about civilizational cycles, the other great pillar of cyclical theory I talk about in my book, Prophets of Doom, both of these thinkers, was Oswald Spengler. Oswald Spengler was also, you know, sought a more poetic way of seeing the world. He had a kind of a romantic or idealist element in his thought. And he was also skeptical about the rule of the merchants. He's got a very good way of thinking about elite classes. He talks about the first estate, the second estate, the third estate. And the problem when the small-minded bourgeoisie, the unheroic, petty, you know, merchants, what happens when they come to predominate entirely? And he warned about what happens when in a culture which loses any sense of anything but commerciality in that way. Another thinker, you know, in the main line of British conservative thought, Roger Scruton. Now, obviously, through the 80s and the 90s, he had to make some sort of peace or settlement with Thatcherism, but he was always critical of those elements that saw only market forces. You know, he makes very eloquent arguments, you know, even against the repeal of the Corn Laws. He sees the tragedy of the losses of those formerly almost permanent structures of everyday life that are lost when you just give over to the rule of profit. He talks about governmental controls around heritage sites, for example. You know, and it is a tragedy when you see something that of historical importance sold off and turned into a hotel or a luxury apartment or something like that, which happens on a fairly frequent basis. And he points to some of the controls in Paris that protect their World Heritage sites, and what would happen if you just allowed McDonald's to buy them, you know. Another thinker who is generally speaking skeptical of capitalism, but is associated with the right, the French New Right, is Alain de Benoist. That is the figure on the top right there. All of these people have interesting things, critiques of capitalism, as does Peter Hitchens and Carlyle and many other figures who have been on the quote-unquote right. And I have long thought, you know, to come back to the kind of burgeoning friendship between Bastani and Peter Hitchens, to go all the way back here. I think that in a strange way, these two figures, even though they sit on opposite ends of the aisle, can understand each other. They actually have more common ground than they do between either of these and your typical Tory boy, your typical kind of snivelling Tory boy, who, you know, they both rightly treat with, you know, borderline contempt. And, you know, this is, it's interesting to see these conversations are starting to happen. And, you know, I hope in the coming year, the more of a conversation needs to start around this, because this is the great problem with reform, if you ask me. It is Nigel Farage's residual Thatcherism that is off-putting to younger people, doesn't really speak to the problems of today, and frankly is aligned with a neoliberal project that is widely seen as bringing us to this point. And, you know, I've been kind of quite appalled to see Trumpism dwindle into neo-Buckleyite settlement. You know, it's like we're getting the return of the neocons and the return of the Chicago School Alliance, you know, Redux, just in a hidden and packaged way. There is some pushback from the likes of Bannon and so on, but it's still kind of there. It's insidiously trying to put itself back together. And increasingly, some of the most ardent apologists for what's happening come to resemble the American version of the Tory boy, who are, you know, and are equally distasteful to many of us. So, yeah, this is an interesting thing. And, you know, I've not been very open to speaking to leftists, you know, in, I don't like debates. I don't like having debates. But I'm much more open to seeing where leftists are right now. You know, they've just suffered a devastating defeat. They've been humiliated. I think woke was a humiliation for the left, personally. I think they've been humiliated by being forced to wear these rainbow flags. And, you know, like they really have been made a mock of, in my view, the old left, the real left. And I genuinely think that we can have better conversations. These two, Hitchens and Pastani, have better conversations than people who are kind of stuck supporting these fake populist movements. The trouble with the populist movements is that they're just wedded to the old paradigm. And we're getting to a point where we need to move beyond that. And, you know, there are lots of Marxist writers who are producing much more interesting work at the moment. I mean, there's that James Hartfield I talked about. I like Michael Hudson. You know, I'm not sure if Hudson's a Marxist, but he's certainly coming from the left. You know, and I think there's interesting stuff being produced by more thoughtful people on the quote-unquote right as well. I mean, I don't really like the labels left and right. I'd like us to just move beyond it and be like, well, look at the shit we're in now. This is the situation we're in. How can we as a society push back against some of these very insidious forces and the financialization of all parts of our society? There's a way of reading Brexit and Trump as reactions against that whole process. You know, various, in my opinion, insidious elites have tried to kind of reframe all of that reaction as being, you know, all about quote unquote woke or cultural Marxism. And yeah, okay, those have been bad forces too. But I think they're all downstream of a much bigger problem, which I've been trying to hint at or hint towards in these recent videos where I've been drawing from leftist thinkers. So, you know, I honestly think the most interesting political directions will be here in this cross section that we're looking at now. And I'm much more interested in being part of that than, you know, my quote unquote online right or dissident right or whatever. To be honest, I feel like Trump has emptied out the intellectual honesty of what was happening there. You know, there was a brief moment a couple of years back where there were exciting things happening, but now that's ossifying and becoming brittle, unthinking, and rigid in a way that does not interest me whatsoever. this here, what we're looking at, is much more interesting. So, yeah, if you're in the, if you watch this, if you are such a leftist, let me know. I'd be open to having a couple of conversations. Foundations of Shakespeare, buy it now, and I'll be back tomorrow with some British news. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.